It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to the Untold Story podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be joined by Josiah Haken. I like to begin these podcasts by, this is Thanksgiving week, by the way, so we hope everyone is in a mood to be grateful and to help others when you're surrounded at your table with your loved ones and abundance in most cases, to think about people who are far less fortunate and who are alone and hungry during this week. And this is really the life work that Josiah takes on. So can you start, Josiah, by just telling us about you, about where you're from, and about why you have dedicated your work to the homeless and to helping the rest of us who are fortunate to have homes understand who they are?
Yeah, absolutely. It's so good to be here with you. I grew up in West Africa. My parents were with a missions organization. And so helping people and trying to connect them to a better life is, I guess, genetic maybe. Mm-hmm. But then my family moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania when I was in high school and ended up moving out to New Jersey about 10 years later and just wanted to get involved. I started off just volunteering at a soup kitchen, washing dishes, mm-hmm. And found out that the people that I was serving were the most interesting and fascinating and just caring people that I've ever met. So I instantly fell in love just hanging out with people who were experiencing homelessness. And that sort of led me on a journey to just looking for ways to get involved and to help bridge the gap between the housed and the unhoused. And that led me to taking a job as an outreach leader with the organization that I'm currently leading called City Relief. And so that started in 2010.
In New York.
In New York. We serve in New York City. We serve in Newark, New Jersey, and in Paterson, New Jersey. And we try to help people get connected to resources. So, but to answer your question, like that for me was just the heartbeat of what I was looking for in terms of having a life of purpose. And so I kind of stumbled into it, honestly. I didn't like, it's not like when you're a kid, you're like, I want to grow up and help homeless people for a living. Like, that's not usually.
That
it's
would
like,
be fun.
It would be. I mean, now my kids, my kids might have a little bias.
Right, right.
But that wasn't something on my radar when I was a kid.
And is it, is there a faith attachment to this for you? You said your parents were missionaries. Is that part of your motivation?
Absolutely. I'm a person of faith. In the scriptures, I describe myself as a follower of Jesus. And, you know, Jesus said at one point in the scriptures, foxes have holes and birds have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Mm-hmm. And so that, I think, was part of my motivation to kind of look for Jesus mm-hmm. in the streets. And turns out I found him. He's all over the place. So for me, that's something that's really important, and it's definitely a motivating factor. But I understand it doesn't have to be a motivating, like you don't have to be a Christian to want to help homeless people. So I'm sort of trying to take my experience and broaden it and empower people of all faiths and all backgrounds to experience something special when they see their homeless neighbors.
Well, that's a beautiful scripture to guide what you're doing. So where have you found Jesus in the streets?
Well, there's probably too many stories to tell, at least for this conversation. But what I have found is that people in the street have a faith, and they have a strength that a lot of us don't even like realize that that we may have or not have, because they're forced to think about their day moment by moment. Because they're surviving, because they're trying to find where they can access food and how they can improve their, stay warm. And what I found is that Jesus resonates with people who are in distress. The story of Jesus as sort of this homeless rabbi who, walked through the highways and byways and engaged with people with love and compassion and helped people who were sick. There's a lot of people who are experiencing homelessness who have health issues. And so I've seen people in the street who have nothing, have absolutely nothing, be generous. Like I've seen people say, hey, I need a pair of socks, not for me, but for my friend. Mm-hmm. And so there are so many people out there who just demonstrate what generosity looks like when they, like the widow's mite, right? Like if someone doesn't have much to give and they just give all they have, that to me reminds, that's Jesus. That's like the heartbeat of God. When we think about Jesus as a person of faith, I think about a God who did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, as it talks about in Philippians, but something like he humbled himself and took on the nature of a servant. And there's no more humbling experience than being without a home. And so I've seen and experienced Jesus in the streets with so many of my friends who are struggling.
So Josiah, tell me, maybe you can give me an example of a person who sort of explains to the rest of us, you know, this person kind of breaks the myths of what people assume. Because when I walk down the street, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are mentally ill on the street, a lot of people who have drug addiction. I like to think of myself as a generous person, but I think, well, if I give this person some money, is it going to go straight to drugs or alcohol? And is that really helping them?
Yeah. I mean, the truth is that there are a lot of people in the street who are struggling with addiction and mental health issues. But I would also challenge the sort of the idea that if someone is in the street, it's almost a foregone conclusion that they are struggling with those things, because there are people struggling with addiction and mental health who are housed. There's 50 million Americans who right now are struggling with some form of mental illness, and yet the vast majority of them manage to stay housed. Mm-hmm. So yes, mental illness is a factor, and drug addiction. There are a lot of people who are suffering from drug addiction in the street. But to answer your question, I would say that, you know, I think sometimes we have to zoom out and look at people through the lens of the context of what they're experiencing. So, for example, if I met a guy who, you know, suffered from drug addiction, he was released from prison. We'll call him John. John was released from prison, ended up in the street, went to a shelter, had a history of drug substance abuse. But the shelter where he was placed, there was a lot of drug activity going on around the shelter, because a lot of times drug dealers will target vulnerable populations. And so if you go into the shelters, a lot of times there are people there who are just trying to just rebuild their lives, but they're being inundated. It's a target-rich environment for predators and for people who want to take advantage of vulnerable people. So he ended up leaving the shelter, not because he wanted to sleep in the street, but because he wanted to stay clean. Mm-hmm. And so there are some people who are actually sleeping outside, not because they're using drugs, but because they're trying to stay off of drugs. Mm-hmm. And I've also met people who are dealing with all kinds of, like, the winter months in New York are brutal. And I know for me, sometimes I, you know, have a tough day at work and I'll go home and the first thing I'll do is crack open a beer. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been a tough day and no one thinks different. No one will give me the side eye. No one will bother me. Mm-hmm. But yet a guy who's sleeping outside with no warm bed, no blanket, no hot meal, like, he cracks open a beer and all of a sudden we're like, oh no, see, he has an alcohol problem. Mm-hmm. When in reality, it's context. Context influences what we, you know, how we interpret behavior. So to answer your question, I would, in terms of like seeing people in the street and trying to help them, I encourage people that you should do what you feel comfortable doing. Meaning, if you don't feel comfortable giving money to somebody, that's totally fine. Like, don't beat yourself up. That's totally okay. But if you do want to give a few dollars to somebody, I would encourage you not to worry about what they're going to do with it, because I get paid. I mean, I work for a nonprofit organization. I get paid by the organization. No one audits my spending. No one checks to see if I'm spending all my money appropriately or on things that are good for me. So if you are going to give a few dollars to somebody, once you've given it to them, it's theirs now. They can do with it as they please. Some of them may use it for, you know, destructive things, but sometimes they'll use it for a Metro card or food. There's people I've met who live off the donations of people, and they don't actually spend it on alcohol.
Okay, so here's, you know, the hard side of this questioning, right? There are help wanted signs all over New York City. People are really struggling to find workers. So why aren't these people taking those jobs and starting to pay for things themselves?
Yeah. First of all, to get a job, I don't know if you filled out a job application. If you've been here for a while, you probably haven't. I haven't. I've been, say, really for 12 years. But I know people who have filled out applications. And usually on the application, you'll notice it starts with your name, usually at the top. The next question is what?
It's your address.
Your address. So if someone doesn't have an address, they're automatically sort of in a position where even if it's a job at McDonald's or it's a job at a, you know, a low-wage job, is there any guarantee they'll get that job if they have no address? What about their uniform? If they're going in for the interview, do they have access to clothing that would actually be required for that job? I know when I worked in as a restaurant worker, I had to get slip-proof shoes way back when, right? And if I couldn't afford slip-proof shoes, the restaurant didn't provide it for me. I would have had to provide it myself. So if I don't have income to be able to provide the uniform that I need to get the job, I can't do it. And then what about identification? I mean, if I had usually the first thing that's required at a job interview is you also have to provide a social security card, a driver's license. And a lot of folks in the street have been forced by circumstance, whether they lost their ID or their ID expired. And now to get a job, it's not just about getting a social security card. It's not about just walking in and applying. It's actually you have to get all this paperwork. So the hoops that we have to jump through just to get to the bare minimum threshold of even being considered for a job is overwhelming to a lot of people who are in the street. And so the idea of saying to that person, now, no, you should just go apply. Like it's complete. I don't know about like for me, I would say to myself, why bother? And I think a lot of people in the street have a why bother mentality, not because they're lazy, not because they're, you know, they just want to, you know, take advantage of the system and the handouts. And but they have a why bother mentality because they've tried and they've been turned away.
So is that part of what City Relief does? I mean, how do we get people from that position to, you know, the shoes and here's an address that you can put on this piece of paper. Maybe it's a shelter. Maybe it's a, you know, some other sort of place. And here are some clothes to go to that job in.
Exactly. So what we do at City Relief is we try to meet people where they are. Because again, if people are have been turned away, rejected, they failed, they just have had no positive momentum. What you have to do is you have to establish trust and have to establish a reason for that person to take you at your word. So what we do is we give out a meal, new socks, toiletries, things that, you know, some people will say, well, you're enabling their homelessness. You're just keeping them in the street. And I would say, actually, what we're doing is we're building trust with a population of people who have been burnt and are so skeptical about anything that resembles good news. So we establish a starting point of trust by just saying, we're practicing generosity, giving this to you for nothing. And then what we do is we say, now, is there something we can do to help you move forward? Is it ID? I was on the phone with a guy last Friday, and I actually called the Social Security Administration to see if I could get him an appointment to go pick up his Social Security card so he can go apply for a job. Well, I was on hold for 30 minutes. Till I went online. I went online, and I was like, oh, there's actually a way to apply online so he can just walk in and pick it up. So I did that with him. Now, he doesn't have a smartphone. So he didn't have access to the internet. So he didn't even, I didn't know it. And I've been doing this for 12 years. How is he supposed to know it? So I was able to go online for him, fill out the application, and now he can go get a Social Security card and hopefully he can move forward. So what we try to do at City Relief is just tear down the barriers and like remove the hoops. I think of it, the way I describe it to people like this is when I go to Home Depot for my wife, because my wife does all the work, the projects in my house, I'm completely useless. but when I go, sometimes she sends me on an errand. She's like, okay, go to Home Depot, I need this. And I'm like, okay. So if I walk into Home Depot.
And because you're so grateful that she's doing that
so
thing.
So grateful.
That's the way my husband loves to cook. And so I love to clean up or shop for the food because I'm just so happy that he loves to do it.
Yes. I will gladly be the runner.
Exactly.
Right? So if I go to Home Depot though, and I have a tool that I'm looking for or a piece of whatever, I will wander the aisles for hours looking for this thing and it will take me forever. Right. I might get lucky and I might find the sign. But again, I may not. So I may wander around forever. Now, if there's a customer service person though, if there's an employee at the door when I walk in who intercepts me and says, excuse me, sir, welcome to Home Depot or welcome to whatever, you know, store you're talking about. What are you looking for? What is it that I can help you find? And in that case, I'll go, oh, I'm looking for X, Y, or Z. And then that person will then walk me directly to that aisle and directly to the place, and I'll find it in 5 minutes. So what we try to do at City Relief is we try to provide this sort of like customer service experience where we're meeting people as they're walking, you know, walking by, and we try to say, excuse me, what can we help you find? Because in New York City, finding the right help and finding the right door and finding the right resource is not a simple thing. So, you know, I don't know if you've tried to call 311 recently. It's great that we have that as an option, but it's certainly not like user friendly, like if you're looking for a specific thing. So we try to bring customer service to folks who are experiencing homelessness, provide the compassion, the trust that allows them to take our word for it, and then we try to point the way. And then what we try to do is actually walk with them, like that customer service associate walking with me to the resource.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
I'm Emily Campagno, host of the Fox True Crime Podcast. January 26th, 1988 was a cold and suspiciously quiet night at the Indianapolis Police Department, but the frigid night took a chilling turn with news of a triple homicide. This week, I'm joined by retired Sergeant Judd Green for a look back at this savage case. Available now on Apple, Spotify, and foxnewspodcast.com.
Tell me, how often do you see success stories, people who go through that process and receive the help they need, and now they are no longer homeless and they're living in their own place again?
We see it all the time. Yeah, we see it all the time. For the number of people who are in the street, and there are many, there are more people who are homeless now in New York than I've seen in 12 years.
Why is that?
Oh my gosh, it's a convergence of factors. I mean, you have the cost of living in New York has gone up 30%. I mean, you have, the average rent for an apartment for one bedroom in Manhattan was like $5,000 back in July. Right. It's the cost of living is absurd, and so a lot of people are getting priced out. It's also the result of 21,000 asylum seekers who have been bused to New York City and have been put into the same queue as all the other homeless folks, which has just added a strain across the board to the system. There's also the impact of inflation. I mean, cost of living is one thing, but also cost of food. So people who have food stamps or depend on food stamps to provide for their families, that's not going as far anymore. Groceries are more expensive. Fuel is more expensive. Transportation is more expensive. So you have people who are picking and choosing what they can pay for and what they can't. And then there's the pandemic and the mental health crisis of people who are dealing. I mean, I have friends personally who are dealing with their kids who are having mental health breakdowns. Mm-hmm. And the system of care for people with mental health issues is just not – it's not substantial. It's not working. And so there's so many people who are falling through the cracks because of that. And then there's the opioid crisis. So you have people who are, 100,000 overdose deaths last year because of the, fentanyl. And so you have all these converging factors right now that are leading to a crisis. And so there's no shortage of opportunity to help people. That's why I try to reframe it. It's like, yes, there's a lot of problems. Which means that there are more opportunities for people who want to help to get involved, because this is on all of us. If we are going to be, trying to be compassionate neighbors, then there's things that we can do to make a difference.
So tell me this. I diverted. So tell me the road to success and what it looks like, and how long does it take to help someone to get back on their feet?
Yeah, the road to success looks different depending on each situation. But what we've seen is that a lot of folks that we encounter, they do qualify for services. There are services out there. It's about connecting them to the right services. So we have helped people navigate the bureaucracy of the shelter system. Like, there's a lot of people who won't go into shelter because of the intake process. So there's ways to advocate around that. And there's ways to work with other organizations and institutions that allow us to sort of help move people to like the express lane to try to help them get off the street. So we've done that. There's also, like I mentioned earlier, identification and documentation. If we can help someone get ID, if we can help them build up their documentation, we can move them forward on the pathway to get housing. There's also just the reality of family reunification. We bump into people a lot who they came to New York because of a job opportunity or a relationship or something that just fell apart, and now they're stuck. And so in some cases, it's as simple as calling up a family member and saying, hey, I'm sitting here with your son. I'm wondering if I could get him to you, would he have a place to live? And a lot of times the answer is yes, please send him home. And the issue was they just didn't have a way of getting them home. Right. And so we'll put them on a bus or we'll put them on a train and we'll get them to where they need to be. So it just depends on the situation. But really what what we've seen over the years is I've seen personally is that the key ingredient is hope. The key ingredient is helping people believe that tomorrow can be different. One of the questions I ask people a lot in the street is, if everything were to go right, I know everything's gone wrong. I know your life has crumbled and it's hard to imagine. But if today was a turning point in your life and everything goes right from here on out, in 1 year, where are you? And so if they can express, oh, in 1 year, I'm working, I have my own apartment, I am reunited with my family, I, you know, am treating my addiction, or I'm treating my mental health issue, or I'm treating my whatever it is, then I can say, okay, let's develop a plan to help you get there. And then we can lay out a plan that might, in some cases, if it's a phone call and a bus ticket, it might take a day. But if it's someone who has no family, no other resources, and we're starting from scratch, it may take longer. But the commitment that we make as an organization is to help them regardless. We tell people we will walk with them as long as they'll walk with us.
You're like an angel showing up to them on the street. And I can only imagine, how much people appreciate the outreach that you're all doing. One of the things that comes up is the question of mental health institutions in New York. Why are there so many people who are so clearly unstable? You hear people, I'll walk down the street, people talking to themselves, spinning these narrative yarns, and just obviously very, very ill. And then we see situations of these same people getting arrested for stabbing someone or being violent, right? So what happened to the structure in the city where these people could stay and be treated so that people are safe from them and so that they are safe?
Yeah, so this is an issue that is, it's was along with, like, it wasn't something that just flipped a switch. This was, we didn't get here overnight. Yeah. There was a wave of institutions that existed to help people with mental health that were closed down. They were terrible. Again, real abuses were happening.
Right.
So they closed them down. But the idea was that then they would redirect the funding from those programs into community-based healthcare centers and whatever. And honestly, the money never made it. They did not redirect the funding from those centers to community. Like, there isn't enough services for those folks. They just ended up on their own in the street a lot of times. So, or in jail. The jail, prisons and incarceration is one of the leading, mental health care areas in our country is prisons. So that is one factor. The other thing is, when COVID hit, a lot of psych beds were reconfigured and actually were turned from mental health beds to COVID units.
Right.
And so a lot of those units were flipped. And so then there's not a lot of money. There's not a lot of profit in mental health care. It's sort of a black hole for financially for a lot of hospitals and a lot of institutions. So I think that's also a factor.
A lot of patients who can't pay the bill.
Yes, exactly. Because of that, you end up with fewer resources. But on top of that, I would also, maybe ask us to kind of rethink the whole thing, the scenario you described. Mental health is also not a zero-sum game. It's not either you're sane and stable or you're out of your mind and dangerous. It doesn't work that way. It's a spectrum. It's we all have good days and bad days. We all have the ability to fly off the handle a little bit depending on if we're triggered in the wrong way or the right way, depending on how you look at it. So what I would say is, I met a guy years ago. Again, I'll call him Steve. Steve was an artist, a street artist, and he would draw pictures of tourists, and he was homeless, but he was stable. And over time, his mental health got worse and worse and worse. So if you take away access to steady sleep, if you just don't sleep through the night, people in the street usually average 2 to 3 hours of sleep a night.
Terrible.
I mean, I can tell you, I'm not mentally well if I'm going on 2 to 3 hours of sleep.
Either.
But if you multiply that out over time, this is why people in the street sometimes are the harder to get off the street, the longer they've been on the street, because their mental health degrades and erodes over time with lack of treatment. I also met a guy recently who had schizophrenia, was diagnosed schizophrenia, was employed though, and was seeing a psychiatrist and a therapist, had his condition under control. It was being managed for 20 years. He was working, stable, et cetera. COVID hit, lost his job, because of his job. His insurance was attached to his job, lost his insurance, lost his doctor. His doctor was connected to his insurance company, lost his doctor. Ended up kind of in between things trying to rebuild. Well, the voices started coming back, started hearing voices. And he told me that he tried to make an appointment through his he signed up for Medicare and was able to get like the you know, sort of cut rate insurance. But the options for him to get treatment, he had to go see a psychiatrist to get the medication. They couldn't just give him the medication he needed that he was receiving for 20 years.
Right.
But he couldn't get it because he, without seeing a psychiatrist first, and the psychiatrist was
there. Has to prescribe it.
Has to prescribe it. And if they're going to prescribe it, they have to see him. And he couldn't get an appointment for 8 weeks. The soonest he could get to see someone was 8 weeks. That means he had 2 months of living with his struggle of mental illness that was stabilized. So I would just posit that people that we see in the street who are dealing with very serious mental illness, they didn't just become that. So we have to really make an effort to try to do better. I would say, just for the people listening, mental health first aid is actually a real thing.
Yeah.
You can look it up. It's very, very helpful. I would encourage everybody to go through the course of mental health first aid because there's so many people around us who are struggling right now, and it will give us a better frame of reference to kind of contextualize when we see that person rummaging through the trash or that person talking to themselves. Mm-hmm. That's just a snapshot on a long trajectory of experiences. Mm-hmm. So we need to rethink that issue more holistically, I think.
The Untold Story continues right after this.
Do people talk about building mental health institutions in New York City so that this person you just described could walk into the mental health emergency room and find a place to stay and to get better? I mean, you know, there used to be institutions out on Randall's Island and those areas. And I just wonder, because, you know, New York City is a very, very rich city. The tax base here is enormous. Students in New York City have more money spent on them per student than maybe two or three other places in the entire country. So why can't we do this?
That's a great question. There's nothing simple, but I think it's about prioritization. I think there isn't a whole lot of incentive to dump a lot of money into mental health care and treatment and facilities. I do know that there's been talk at a government level about supportive housing. If you listen to any of the mayoral debates going back before Mayor Adams took office, supportive housing was mentioned all the time. Basically, that's housing that's built for people who struggle with mental health issues, who need like on-site care, which is what the goal would be for people who are struggling with severe mental health issues, is a supportive housing context. The problem, though, again, is there are not enough supportive housing units. And the other problem is that supportive housing units often will be prioritized for people who are not quite so bad that they might be difficult to deal with. People actually will choose which applicants they accept into their supportive housing.
Well, they're building a community.
Exactly.
So they are keeping that in mind. And if you're helping a certain number of people, is that better than not doing it at all?
Again, I'm a pragmatist.
Right.
So I would say yes.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I would say, but we also wonder, what about this guy who's on the street who's talking to himself or having, you know, severe psychosis? Right. Like, that guy, like, if you don't want that guy in the subway.
What happens if that guy checks into the emergency room?
Again, oftentimes they, this is anecdotal. I don't have stats to back this up. But from my experience, what happens often is that that person is at the emergency room quite a bit. And so they are often not taken as seriously as someone else. And so they will be triaged and then discharged.
Time to get back out.
Yes, because unless their issue is acute, oftentimes Medicaid and Medicare, like, they won't cover like treatment, like long-term, like unless it's outpatient. So they're not going to admit somebody who is healthy, but just unstable. They have to be a certain level of unstable to be admitted. And then if they're admitted for suicidal ideations or homicidal ideations, it's a 72-hour wait. But then eventually, again, if they're not admitted into a longer term situation, people without homes end up just getting discharged right out to the street because of a lack of resources.
Yeah.
So It's a tough situation.
You know, so many of the things that you've described, and, you know, I just have a couple more questions for you, but so many of the things that you've described make me so angry about the dysfunction of bureaucracy, because we ought to be able to do better than this. We ought to be able to, I mean, the number of people who are in this category, even though it's grown a lot, it ought to be a manageable category. We are an incredibly wealthy nation, an incredibly wealthy city. And I heard actually just yesterday, I was talking to an economist. He said that there's $50,000 available for every single person who's in the bottom quintile of the U.S. economy, considered to be poor. $50,000, which would make some people say, why don't these people access everything that's available to them? And they could be, you know, maybe not in New York City, but maybe in a town not too far away, renting an apartment for $800 a month and getting food stamps. And, you know, these things are out there. So why aren't they taking advantage, full advantage of it?
It's accessibility. I mean, you mentioned the word bureaucracy. It's a real thing. Like the systems that are designed to help people who are struggling, who are struggling with financial poverty, they are built sort of based on like the lowest common denominator. Like they kind of try to create a system that will accommodate as many people as possible, which then requires sort of like reporting and access, and you have to account for what you're doing, and you have to, like, there's all of this red tape that you just need to get one person helped. So it makes it just so huge. Like I mentioned, the guy I called to get a social security card, and I was on hold for a half hour. Like,
he had one before.
He just lost it. He needed a replement.
Right.
So
he's in the system.
Yes,
is my point.
Exactly.
Right. He just needs to get a new card.
Correct.
Sent to him,
and he knows his number. And the issue is like access. So like even the shelter system in New York City, right? Like I mentioned, one of the things that keeps people out of the shelter, because a question I get a lot is
why isn't everyone just in a shelter?
Why aren't they in a shelter? It's a right to shelter city. Well, and they're like, well, then they must be choosing to sleep in the street. Mm-hmm. But then people make the next leap, which is a faulty one, which is, oh, then they're choosing to be homeless. Mm-hmm. And the answer is they're not choosing to be homeless. They're choosing not to sleep in a shelter.
Right.
There's a difference. You know, if you say you can go this way or that way, and the person says, okay, this way is terrible, so I'm going that way. And then you're like, ha, you like it. You want to go that way. It's like, no, you gave me a binary choice. Right. I could either sleep outside or sleep in a shelter. Yeah. I chose to sleep outside.
The shelters are really so horrible that no one wants to go there?
The reputation of the shelter system is horrible. Not all shelters are created equally.
Are some run by churches as well, or they're all run by the city, or people have an option between those two?
So the city-run shelter system is a massive system. Department of Homeless Services. It's under the Social Security Social Services Administration. There's 63,000 people in the New York City shelter system.
63,000
individuals who are sleeping in a city-run shelter, a city-contracted shelter.
Every night, that's how many beds there are, 63,000.
That was as of November 15th.
How long can you stay?
You can stay as long as you need. As long as you're, again, you're checking the boxes that allow you to qualify for that stay.
So there's 63,000 city beds. What about churches?
Well, again, that's not the total number of beds. That's the number of residents who are in those beds based on the census that Department of Homeless Services keeps, which is the highest it's ever been, by the way. November 15th of this year is the highest, like 63. I don't know. In October, we broke the record, and then now we've been breaking it sort of up and down. But church beds are different. There are faith communities that provide beds for people who are homeless, but they're a fraction of the number, tiny, tiny number. And there's a lot of, the bureaucracy or the process of trying to get a church bed. Unless you go, there aren't a lot of churches you can go directly to where you will then get placed, because the system is set up like a funnel. So all the men who are homeless in New York end up going through the Department of Homeless Services intake shelter at Bellevue. The women, there's an intake in Brooklyn, there's an intake in the Bronx. Families, again, different intake center. So there's all these sort of entryways into the shelter system. If there is an organization, like there are private missions and shelters that provide like a bed for a short period of time, if it's just truly shelter. Mm-hmm. If someone's looking for an inpatient program, that's different. It's a whole different sort of subset of options. But a lot of people, just for a free bed to sleep in, most of them are going to end up in a city shelter or on the sidewalk. If they do go to, say, the Bowery Mission or, one of the, I'm thinking of Missionaries of Charity. If they go, if people go to these places directly, their stay is usually limited to like 2 weeks, unless they enter into some sort of like, again, more intensive program. Now, a lot of people are just trying to find, like, rebuild their lives. And so an intensive program isn't appealing, or they don't qualify for some reason. So people who go to the faith-based shelters often don't stay very long, which is hard because you're not going to solve your situation of homelessness in usually in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So that's why it's sort of a revolving door. So a lot of people will go in and out, whereas the city shelters are designed to let people stay longer because it takes more time. But the city shelters require the bureaucracy of going through intake. So it's a mixed bag, and it's just complicated.
So, I mean, this is an enormous subject. Does the city then say to the people in the shelter, okay, let's get you a job. Let's try to find you, let's get you, help you get out of this situation. Is that a channel that is open and working?
Open may or may not be working, or working for some, not all. Again, they are trying. There's so many individual problems that keep people stuck through the process. So they may say, yes, there is a pathway for a job, mm-hmm. but maybe they don't have capacity to actually help that person look, mm-hmm. which is, again, something why City Relief exists, to try to help people. So like, we talk to folks a lot. One of the first questions we ask is, are you working with a caseworker? Mm-hmm. Because what happens is these caseworkers oftentimes are underpaid. They're overworked. Sure. They don't have
700 cases.
Exactly. So like, having the capacity to help that person, truly help them. And like, again, there's not usually a magic solution.
Right. Everybody's different.
Yeah. So finding the pathway for each person requires a more holistic approach. And if you are in a system where you're a caseworker for a floor of people, you're just limited by time and space to be able to help them effectively.
So City Relief, give people an example. So if they want to do something and they want to give to City Relief, where is their money going to go? And give them an example of the kind of success that you have seen happen as a result of these donations.
Yeah. So if someone gives to City Relief, it's going largely to our program, but 75-80% of our funding that comes in goes directly to program, which is the outreaches that we do, the outreach workers, the meals, the supplies that we distribute, as well as the caseworkers that then do that supportive care coordination for the people that we serve. So we do 8 weekly pop-up outreach events throughout New York City and New Jersey, where we're serving about 1,300 people a week. And we, again, provide a meal and socks and supplies so that we can build trust. And then we have caseworkers and we have people who are doing intakes, and we mobilize thousands of volunteers every year that will come alongside of us and create an environment for people to be cared for. And then what we do is we bring people in to our guest services and our care coordinations, and we invite other organizations to partner with us. So we can kind of create a one-stop shop right on the sidewalk for people to find us very easily, because we're going to right where they are. We're setting up on a sidewalk and they can find us, and then we're inviting organizations to come alongside of us so we can get them directly connected. That's where the money would be going, is to help us provide that service to as many people as we can. We can only 8 events a week at this point. With more resources, we could do more events. We could help more people. Mm-hmm. It's just a scalability based on resources. And obviously, the needs we're seeing now are historic. So it's really challenging. But our model is effective because there's one guy who we met a long time ago. His name is Willie. Willie was in the Bronx. He was homeless for 40 years. 40. That's 40. Left home at 17. End up in the street. Toxic home life. Ended up addicted to drugs. Ended up, again, just living day by day for 40 years. He came to our outreach for the meal originally. He just wanted a cup of soup and the bread. We offer a vegan soup that's mm-hmm. really delicious. We make it fresh every day. It's our special recipe. And so people really enjoy it. They're sitting down, they're enjoying their soup, and then we're having conversations with them. And so over time, one of our volunteers built a relationship with Willie. And she found out he ended up in the hospital with an accident. He had an accident. And so she took balloons and a card to the hospital to visit Willie and give him a balloon and some cards. And Willie spoke at one of our fundraisers about 10 years ago. And he said that when she walked in with the balloons and the card, he realized that she, if she cared about him, if she thought he was worth visiting, maybe he was worth trying to improve his life and change his life. And it was her compassion and her concern as a volunteer of City Relief that actually led him to that spark of hope that allowed him to start making progress towards rebuilding his life. So we were able to get him into a rehab program, able to get him into an apartment, a job with a church that we collaborated with. And he's, you know, his life was changed after 40 years on the street. So I tell that story because it can happen. Like that guy who seems hopeless and seems beyond all measure
just
of—
just needed somebody to know that somebody cared about him
and
enough.
Provide the
a small
the
act.
Pathway forward.
Well, thank you for the work that you're doing in New York City and in New Jersey, where I live. And we see this problem growing all over the place and all over the country. So thank you very much for talking with us, Josiah. And people can find you and your organization how?
So you can find cityrelief.org is very easy to find. Also on Instagram, it's at cityrelief, TikTok. I also wrote a book called Neighbors with No Doors, The Truth About Homelessness.
It's a very good book. I highly recommend it. It's The Truth About Homelessness and How You Can Make a Difference.
Yep. So if you look that up, you'll be able to find more about me. And it's just full of stories of my friends who I've met in the street and people I've been able to help.
Well, thank you for the respect that you give to this community and for your approach and sensitivity and love of them and giving us a little bit better understanding of what they're going through. Thanks, Josiah.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Untold Story with Martha McCallum. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Make sure to rate and review. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Listen ad-free with the Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to this show ad-free on the Amazon Music app.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.